This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name's John Olenine. I'm the lead curator on the Defining Moments in Australian History project, and I'd like to welcome you all here today for this panel on millennials and Australian history. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal and Yangtze people who are the traditional custodians of the land that we are meeting on today and pay respect to their elders both past and present, and I extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in attendance today. I'd like to acknowledge our partners, of course, ABC Radio National, the Big Ideas Program and Paul Barclay. Thank you very much, as usual. And the Griffith Review, whose latest publication, Millennials Strike Back, inspired the panel that we have here tonight. And I should also mention that it's on sale down in the lobby if you're interested. A little introduction on the Defining Moments in Australian History project. This series of panels with Radio National's Big Ideas program is part of the Defining Moments in Australian History project here at the museum. Through Defining Moments, what the museum is endeavouring to do is to generate a program that engages the public in a discussion about key events, themes, and changes in Australian history. And our aim there is to encourage differing opinions and discussions around those views, and through that, demonstrate that Australian history is not simple or one-sided, but a complex, nuanced, debatable narrative that we should all have a say in. And I have no doubt that the panel here tonight will forward that objective. And really with that, I'd like to hand it over to Paul for some more formal introductions. And again, thanks everybody for coming tonight.
Thanks, John. Can I just say one or two things before I begin the actual recording? Mobile phones on silent, please, but there's no need for you to be quiet. A little bit of audience noise is good. What I'm doing tonight with this panel discussion is that I'm recording a radio program for my show Big Ideas on RN, and so for the purposes of recording, I'm going to treat this discussion that I'm about to have with our guests as if it's going live to air right now, so that I don't need to edit it later on. So if I do make references, as I will throughout the program, to ABC, RN and Big Ideas, if that sounds odd, that's the reason why I'm doing it. The radio component will last about 55 minutes. At the end, I'll wrap up with the guests, and if you could applaud at the end, that will be great. And then after you've finished applauding, don't get up, because we do have some time for audience questions. Hope all of that makes sense to you. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Now, what I'd really like to kick off with is a huge round of applause to get us started. So I wonder if, on the count of three, before I kick off the introduction, if I can get you to make some noise, that will be brilliant. One, two, three. This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay here at the National Museum of Australia. How have younger Australians through the generations helped to define Australia's culture and identity? And how are the millennials forging the future? RN and the National Museum of Australia have been shining a light on some of the defining moments and themes of Australian history. We've talked about post-war immigration, our obsession with sport, about individual moments like the 67 referendum, the Mabo ruling, the apology, the gold rushes, the arrival of the contraceptive pill. It's clear that it's not just old white men who have shaped our history. It is the young who have fought the wars in Gallipoli, in Vietnam, in Iraq, and protested against those wars. The young who've typified our anti-authoritarian streak. Ned Kelly was 26 when he was hung. Young migrants and the children of migrants have altered the social mix. Activist movements, feminism, LGBTI rights, anti-censorship, all had youth at the helm. The generation known as millennials grew up at the last gasp of the 20th century and early 21st century. They've not known a world without the internet or a world without hex either. They're the best educated, the most connected generation, but how do they see their future and how will they shape it? Tonight, the perspective of millennials. It's a great pleasure to be joined at the museum by five guests. We have on my immediate left, Jen Rayner, political advisor and author of Generation Less, How Australia is Cheating the Young. Next to Jen, Andre Dow, writer and human rights advocate. Next to Andre, we have Tamika Townsend, a Ingarigo and Darringanj woman who works in Indigenous affairs. Next to Tamika, we have Frank Bongiorno, cultural historian and author of The 80s, The Decade That Transformed Australia. And at the end of the panel, we have Holly Ransom, chief executive of Emergent Consultancy and Intergenerational Commentator. Frank, you're not a millennial, so like myself, you were born in the 60s. The upside of this is that we do have a historical vantage point that we can look back on that's on our side. Do you think it's true that young people have been the drivers of much of the social change throughout Australian history?
They often have. You know, one thinks back to earlier generations, the cornstalks, you know, the first generation of Australian-born children of convicts, and there was all sorts of puzzling, you know, would they inherit the supposedly criminal traits of their parents? The gold rush generation was young. These were often people in their 20s, in the 1850s, and they in turn gave rise to a really dynamic generation in the 1880s, their children, if you like, which led to this kind of demographic bubble. And then, of course, you know, closer to the recent past, the baby boomers and right through to the millennials. So, look, in many cases, young people have been a really dynamic element in Australian history. And it's something that I guess historians often underestimate. We're not good at generations in some ways. We're better at things like class and ethnicity and gender. And we sometimes struggle with generations because it's kind of a complex idea. I mean, generation means nothing unless it's about shared experience, I think. But
how useful are those labels like Gen Y, Gen X, baby boomer, millennial? For historians, do they provide much that's useful?
A little bit, I think. I mean, it's interesting. When I was doing the 1980s book, it struck me that the dominant political class in the 80s, interestingly, wasn't baby boomer. It was a slightly older generation that didn't have a name. It was those who kind of were in their 20s in the 1950s. People like Bob Hawke, for instance, born in 1929. And it struck me that, you know, they had a particular generational experience that was different from baby boomers, but which I had to come to terms with if I wanted to understand that period. Mm. You know, they'd been, if you like, young people during the Cold War of the 1950s. And I often thought about that, but I still suspect that as a historian I probably underestimated it, because I just think we do tend to emphasise a lot of other identities at the expense of generations, and in some ways that's a pity.
And what about millennials themselves as a group? How do they compare with other generations? What do you think it is that's distinctive about millennials?
Yeah, look, I think the association, especially of communications technology, is something, but, you know, even technology in general is something that we haven't seen before. So we don't define baby boomers, I think, primarily by their relationship to a technology. Obviously, it was the age of television. Mm. But we think of baby boomers, I think, more in relation to politics, don't we? The Vietnam War, perhaps the student radicalism of the 1960s. For my 1980s youth, a term that was used back in the 80s was the MTV generation, you know, referring to consumer culture, but not really to a technology. And I think that association with Facebook, with Twitter, with the digital world generally is powerful. And I think increasingly now in Australia too, with two forms of disadvantage too, and that is home ownership, very much so, the difficulties of breaking into the property market, and casual work and the insecurity of jobs, basically, for that generation. I think they're increasingly emerging as kind of defining experiences. It's a kind of post-GFC experience, actually.
We've been talking about the defining moments of history throughout this series. And interestingly, after one of the earlier discussions, some young people came up and said, oh, look, all this stuff that you're talking about, it just doesn't resonate with me at all. So I thought before we go any further, I'd bring the millennials in and get a sense of what the defining moments of Australian history are to you. Now, Tamika, I was talking to you earlier and you were telling me that the 67 referendum still really speaks to you.
Yeah, definitely.
Tell us about that and perhaps some other moments that resonate with you.
The 67 referendum comes straight to mind because I had the privilege of meeting some of the campaigners earlier this year, and it just made me realise, like, we truly do stand on the shoulder of giants. As a young Indigenous person and other young Indigenous people that are coming through and sort of passionate about making change. And I think that when it comes to the 67 referendum and not only that, but the freedom rides, and I think that Indigenous Australians have been at the forefront of the fight for their rights in their own country. And I guess the 67 referendum is an example of that. Like, my mum is Indigenous, my dad's non-Indigenous, and my grandmother speaks about, my non-Indigenous grandmother speaks about, she was walking over that bridge, she was a part of that. And I think that when I think of the referendum, it makes me believe in Australia. And because I think about 98% of the country, like most referendums fail. And I think that the fact that that went through shows that
we came together as a
nation. It was the first time in our history that we did that, and it shows that there is hope of that. You know, we see so much negative stuff in the media and wherever else, and I think that that was a real milestone, and it gave us, you know, the right to vote, the right to be a citizen, essentially. And without that, I wouldn't even be sitting here today. If it wasn't for the 67 referendum, I think it was important.
Holly, defining moments?
I think probably building on that, definitely the apology was a really significant moment. Mm. It was long overdue, but seeing our Prime Minister get up and apologise for what had been done to Indigenous Australians, I think was a really significant milestone in the road to reconciliation. I think probably another moment, irrespective of your side of politics, particularly as a young woman, seeing the first female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, come to power and shatter the glass ceiling in that aspect of society was a really significant moment. I think there's a lot that's said around you can only be what you can see, and I think about the significance of what that will mean generationally for young women who, for a period of time, had a Governor General, had a number of Premiers of State and a Prime Minister who were all female. And the ripple effect that will have on the way they aspire and the way they think about what they're capable of achieving, I think that was a really significant moment as well.
Mm. Andre?
I think something that was quite defining for me in my childhood was the Tampa crisis, twinned with the September 11 attacks, which came pretty much exactly the same time. And I think my memory of the years after those two events are very taken up with the rhetoric around both boat people generally, which came home to me because my parents were Vietnamese boat people in the 80s. And so as a child, taking on that rhetoric and thinking about what my place in Australia was. And then obviously the changes to anti-terror laws and so on after September 11. I think we're still grappling with both of those events and the consequences from
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. I mean, they shape the society, the Australia we live in now, still very much, don't they? Mm. Jen?
I think there are two, and one of them for me is also the Tampa crisis, but for reasons that it bookended another event in our history, which I think is also very significant, which was the Snowy Hydro scheme. And because that sort of really marked Australia embracing the world in a way that we had never previously done up until that point. We had been very fearful and very suspicious and very concerned about people coming from overseas. And with Snowy Hydro, we sort of basically embraced the potential of what immigration could be, or we started to. And then that led to a whole range of other changes right through to the acceptance of asylum seekers and refugees in the 70s and 80s and a much more open and cosmopolitan view of what Australia could be like. for me, then the Tampa kind of bookends that as really the end of that era and the start of the turn back to being quite a fearful and closed society in a lot of ways, and where you get to the point now where you have echoes of sort of very early colonial protectionist, anti-globalist rhetoric in our political debate.
Mm. So let's talk about your generation. Holly, what do you think it is that defines the millennial generation in a nutshell?
One of the words that would definitely come to mind for me when I think about what it is that I think is a defining trait of the generation, definitely taking the optimistic slant on things, mm-hmm. is purpose. When you look at studies that are done around millennials, when we look at what they're looking for in work, we see purpose and their ability to connect into something that's bigger than themselves as really significant. We hear anecdotally all the time, and I think that's the encouragement of a baby boomer generation of parents to pursue what you love and do what you're passionate about, and that being the language that we heard from a very young age. But I think that want to make an impact, to do something that matters, to be able to say, I was here and I made a difference because of that, I think is a really significant thing. I'd agree with Frank's comments around technology when we think about probably what will define this period. The term digital natives is the one that we often use and throw around. And I think that's an interesting one because you can take a variety of different angles on that particular part of the nutshell. There's a lot of positives to that level of connectedness, the way that that level of technological understanding and capability is enabling solutions to all sorts of problems, the creation of businesses at a fraction of the cost of what we've seen before. But I think there's also challenges for what that means for, say, slacktivism with regards to social activism. The concerns I have when I have conversations with neurologists around what they believe is happening to empathy because of the percentage of our conversations and interactions that are now taking place via digital device instead of person-to-person eye contact and the like, and what that means for mental health and community and belonging.
Yeah.
So I think they would be the two things. Purpose for me, and certainly the relationship with technology, which are very significant. And obviously both of those things as well, I think, have an impact on the way they interact with the world of work and what they do with life.
If I could add one more as well. I think it's change is the other thing that really defines millennials more so than other generations. The pace of change that we have seen in our lives, whether technological, political, economic, but then also our attitude to that change. Older generations tend to have the approach that things are the way that they have been and should stay the way that they have been, whereas millennials, partly I think because we have seen so much change, have a much more suck it and see kind of attitude, a much more roll with it and see where things end up, and it could be good, it could be bad, but you know, we'll deal with that when we get there sort of approach.
Even though that change has not necessarily been all that great for millennials, because you say that one of the defining characteristics of millennials is that they're the first generation since the Great Depression who are in fact worse off than their parents. How so? How are millennials worse off?
Well, any indicator that you would choose to look at, basically, unfortunately, and we probably haven't got time to run through all of them tonight, but, I mean, a few quick stats. Young people are working casually more than ever before, and that's not just people who are at university, it's people who are not at university as well, people who would otherwise have been in, you know, stable and secure work in their late teens and early 20s. Personal wealth is going backwards. Home ownership is lower than it's ever been. Wage growth is slower for people in their early 20s than for any other aspect of the distribution. In terms of our mental health and well-being, we express worse outcomes. In terms of, as Holly sort of flagged, some of those social empathetic connectedness elements, we're worse off. I mean, my focus as an economic policy advisor is obviously on the economics of it, and that's really where you see it in the world of work, in the world of people's personal finances, and of course in terms of home ownership and opportunity to get ahead.
Yes, Andre, insecure employment, hex debt, unaffordable housing. With all of these kind of pressing financial and money worries, where does that leave social justice and social concerns? Do millennials care about those issues as much as their predecessors in previous generations, or are they simply too concerned in finding out whether they can get the money to, you know, rent a house, let alone buy one?
I think young people are absolutely concerned with those issues of social justice. The question, I think, that these material conditions raises is whether or not young people have the space to have the broad thinking that's required to really address the larger underlying problems. So yeah, I think the danger of this current moment, particularly if you're looking at populist politics and the concerns post-GFC, really is that we can fall into, I think, a defensive position of...
Yes. And so you were talking, yeah, about the fact that there are pressing kind of financial imperatives, but that social justice and social concerns still matter. So is it true, because you do hear it said, that millennials are not as politically engaged as, say, the baby boomers were?
Well, I think the politics are different. Well, I was at a conference in Canberra a couple of years ago that was themed around the youth game changers, and almost all the people that got up on stage and spoke really forcefully about visions for the future were people in the tech sector. And their politics were very optimistic, but they're also, I think, quite libertarian. And the solutions were based around the market, and they had a faith in the market and in deregulation, essentially, as a kind of government get out of our way and we'll invent the solutions to the problems. And a really striking moment for me was when, at the end of the first pitch session, the conference convener said, you know, we've had so many great ideas here, but no one's addressed... one of the big issues in Australia is, you know, asylum seekers, does anyone want to get up here and pitch, you know? And after all of these kind of tech-based solutions, I've, as someone who works in refugee advocacy, felt that it was very difficult to stand up and say, look, there's going to be a technological solution to this. It's got to be a political solution. And so I think that's the danger is for... you know, a lot of young people in the tech sector, they're the ones that are the thought leaders and the ones who are getting up and presenting a vision of the future. But the young people who are more interested in social justice and progressive ideals, I think, are perhaps too nervous to stand up and say, let's, you know, how do we create a truly egalitarian society?
Yeah, what's your take, Holly?
Can I add in on that? Because I think one of the other interesting elements about the political system goes to the lack of trust that broadly we've got in institutions right now all around the world, and the way that that's showing up in election result after election result. I mean, the Edelman Trust Barometer this year was pretty extraordinary when you looked at the decline in every country they measured in trust in general in institutions. And when you look at the Pew research that's been done looking generationally at trust, millennials have the lowest trust in institutions of any generation by double digits.
Yep.
So I think in part of that, you look at the world, and Andre, you alluded to some of this earlier, like the global financial crisis. Really, since then, things like full-time work haven't recovered. For every job in Australia right now that's going full-time, there's five Australians that want it. And to a degree, I think there's a number of times, and this isn't just to the government system, this is also a little bit to corporate world. I mean, you look at the government landscape and you go, okay, well, there was kind of a social contract. If you went and did your learning, you were meant to go get to go do your earning. And that's broken down quite fundamentally when we look at the rates of youth unemployment and youth underemployment in particular, as was mentioned by Jennifer. And I think from a corporate standpoint, I mean, we did things like we put a Heart Foundation tick on a Big Mac. Mm. I mean, what happened? Mm. Are we surprised we've lost trust, right? Yeah. So I think part of it is people looking at the system and going, I'm actually not convinced that that's a problem solver. And I'm not actually convinced that I can get in there and I can be a voice for change and this is a vehicle capable of doing something different. I think there will need to be, and I think there will be, an emergence of new institutions and a dramatic changing of existing ones in order to ensure we can keep meeting the need that they need to serve in society. But I think that's part of the breakdown right now. Young people are looking at increasingly complex problems, because that's the state of the world that we're in right now, that are typically now cross-country problems, things like climate change, where it's not necessarily just one country's role to solve it. It's a collective international effort that needs to be led. And at the same time, they're looking at systems that seem to not be working and going, well, how do I actually play a meaningful role in contributing to a solution here? I'm not quite sure how it works in this current context.
Frank, what's your take on it historically? Do you think that the lack of faith in political institutions such as government that we're seeing today is unique, or is this something that we've seen throughout history?
I think the depth of the distrust now is quite unique, actually. I think the stats bear that out as far as we have statistics on these things. I mean, you know, Australians have traditionally, at different points, been distrustful of politicians, you know, cynical when politicians vote themselves pay rises and these sorts of things. But no, we're look at the ways, the inability of the major political parties now to corral votes. I mean, a growing number of votes are going to independents, to minor parties, and that is one measure, I think, of the difficulties that the political system is having in absorbing the current shocks of economic, social, political change.
Well, the inability to resolve issues that clearly the public wants resolved. I was talking to a millennial the other day about the issue of same-sex marriage, an issue that millennials feel strongly about, and they said to me, they cannot think of another issue where government insists on a plebiscite being taken of the public opinion before a decision is made. And they see that as just completely cynical, and all sort of trust and faith evaporates as a result.
With very good reason. I mean, that's one where, you know, fairly consistent public polling majorities seem not to be able to translate into a public policy solution. And yet we look, you know, across the other side of the globe, and a country with a legacy like Ireland's of conservatism is able to resolve these issues satisfactorily, admittedly in that case via a plebiscite, but nonetheless it doesn't place Australia in a very flattering light. The other one that I think, which I've already mentioned, is housing, where, you know, the contrast, I suppose, between the political order of, say, the late 1940s, where both political parties saw that they had a responsibility to deal with what was then a very pressing problem. The fact that very little housing had been built during the Depression and then during the war. There was a massive shortage. Of course, the beginnings of the baby boom in 1944, 45, 46. Shortage of housing, couples living with their parents in all sorts of stressful situations. But the difference then was that there was a sense on both sides of politics that government had a central role to play. It was a very simple solution. We build houses. They disagreed about what to do with that. So on the Liberal side, we'll sell them off. On the Labor side, we'll rent them out. But there was broad agreement that this was something that government should do. And I think if people are, you know, distrustful of politicians today, it's perhaps something to do with the narrowing of scope of our politics, a sense
that one of the things in the book, Generationless, that I am reasonably firm with my peers on, which is that it is actually up to us to get involved in the processes that make those decisions. Because I think that Andre's right, and Holly as well, that there's a tendency in millennials to think that there is a technology hack for everything and that the solution to everything is to break it all down and start again. And I don't believe that that's always the case. You can't hack your way to a new form of democracy within a very established system. The most effective thing that you could do is actually go out and get involved in the system that we've got. And young Australians are doing that less and less. I mean, we know that electoral enrolment is very, very low among people who are in their sort of late teens, early 20s. And then that has a tendency to flow through to their later life. And similarly, to actually get involved with political parties, like mainstream ones, and stand for election. Now, there may be institutional, you know, things that prevent them from wanting to do that, particularly some of the structures of the parties. But if you're not at the table, you don't generally get a say in what's decided around it. And young people need to be there in order to have that say.
Tamika, I was going to ask, how included in Australian society do young Indigenous millennials feel today? And do you feel that you're better off than your parents and grandparents were?
Yeah, definitely. I think that I was just down in Bega on the weekend, actually, and my auntie was telling stories of how they used to sit on opposite sides of the cinema. So, you know, that doesn't happen today, and that's, I think she's only like 60. Also just met up with my nan's sister was taken away when she was very young, and I've actually just reconnected with her daughter this week, actually. So, you know, she's like 39. Her mum was stolen away, lost her connection with culture, knows none of us, even though they've grown up in Yass and we've just been in Bega and got relatives all over Canberra. So, yeah, I think that when you look at not so long, like we've come a hell of a long way in only like 25, 30 years. So that just shows, you know, that change does come. And I just wanted to come back to your point. I think I really agree with that we can't, you know, we got to, and what you said as well, we can only be the change that we see. And we need to be on the inside. And then when when we start to change that cycle, we can see kind of real real change on the inside. Like, we need to be a part of it, but young people also feel disconnected from it. Like, and how do you be a part of something when you're more likely to be homeless, or, you know, a young Indigenous person is more likely to go to jail than to finish school. So how do you be a part of something when it's so distant and disconnected from you is the challenge as well. But we do need to be in there, young people, you know, no matter what colour you are, we need to be a part of it. And break the cycle.
Millennials do cop a bit of a bad rap from some of the older generations, from the baby boomers and Gen Xers. It's said that millennials are a bit self-obsessed, that they tend to overrate their own abilities when it comes to the workforce, that they're just not prepared to do the hard yards and put in the hard work. Any truth in this?
Too much smashed avocado. Don't you get that?
I'm going to come to the smashed avocado.
Statistic, actually, I mean, one of the biggest sort of cliches about millennial workers is that we hop around too much and we're not prepared to stay with any one employer for any period of time, and, you know, that sort of distinguishes us in the workforce. The data completely doesn't bear that out. Younger people have always had shorter work tenures. The duration of having a job for younger people has always been somewhere between 2 and 3 years. What's actually happened is that older Australians have started staying in work for shorter periods. So the average used to be 10 years, now it's down to 7. And so that actually reflects a whole bunch of changes in the economy about how easy it is to keep secure work, how long companies are actually having people work for them. So there is definitely a change going on in people hopping around work, but it's not young people that are doing it. It's actually the baby boomers and the older people.
Yeah. Holly, what do you think about your generation? I mean, you've got a ferocious work ethic. Do you think that millennials generally share that inclination to roll up their sleeves and get into it?
I think this is the difficult thing when you're trying to paint an entire generation with a broad sweeping brush, right? Like, I am so privileged to get to work right around this country with young people across every state and territory, and I'm blown away by the innovation and the work ethic and the ideas and ingenuity of so many of them. I think there is some truth to some of the piece around and this comes from, I think, being a generation that have grown up with technology at our fingertips and in many ways almost as the default parent, where because of the instantaneity of your engagement, the fact that you can type something into Google and press search and in a fraction of a second you get a result, it doesn't surprise me that we've moved to a shorter-term decision-making cycle and expectation around input and output. And I think that is a real challenge that's playing out in the workplace. I was reading a statistic the other day that was talking about, to use a parallel, the average American male, and the fact that by age 18, the average American male will have spent 10,000 hours gaming, which is the equivalent number of hours they will have spent at school in that period of their life. Mm. And so you think about that, and you think about the notion of how gamifying life then applies. The expectation every time you demonstrate a competency in a game, you get to level up. You get a new role or a new position or a new, you know, capability within the game. And in many ways, I think there's sort of a projection of some of these sorts of digital phenomena onto the world that we interact with, just because of the degree to which the way that we've interacted with the world has been informed and kind of guided by that.
Mm.
But I definitely believe millennials have a great work ethic. I think one of the challenges that workplaces have is people that millennials want different things from work. And I think that's a healthy thing. When we look at the Gallup data around engagement of Australians in the workforce, you know, it suggests only about 24% of us are actually engaged in our jobs. So the fact that we're pushing for work to be something that's a bit more fulfilling, that where we can bring more of ourselves to work every day, where we feel we've got the capability to show up and give the best of ourselves, I think is probably a really healthy thing.
Perhaps that's because you're the most educated generation and you've been told that is possible, perhaps, because I think with previous generations, I just think there was a large proportion of people in the workforce who never really expected to like their work very much and never really expected it would have a great deal of meaning. But perhaps with millennials, that is a different feature.
Yeah, and I think that also explains the quality that millennials have that older people, I know, find particularly objectionable, which is our capacity and willingness to say, yeah, but why?
Mm.
Yeah. Something is that way, but why is it that way? Why couldn't it be this way instead? Why wouldn't we try that? It's because educated people are empowered people. If you've been to university, you are taught at university to question things and to think laterally and to think differently about how you might solve problems. And there has been no other generation that has as many people who have actually had that experience, I think, as ours.
I mean, that came with HECS. I mean, you mentioned HECS before, but the other thing that accompanied that was a massive expansion of tertiary education, which has been underestimated. We forget just how large it was. And, I mean, the other thing I'm struck by, too, is that the richness, I think, of the experience of my own students at university now compared to us in the late 1980s. I remember at Melbourne University in the late 80s, there was a young woman, Rita, and Rita went to Paris during the semester. And we thought this was the most glamorous thing imaginable. I mean, I had my first passport at 28, I think. My students, I mean, I've had one student in this break who's covered for Australian newspapers two major overseas sporting events, and now he's just going to come back and continue his studies at the beginning of semester. It's a different world. Now, not everyone shares in that world, but if you compare roughly similar cohorts of, say, university students in the late 80s to now, they are two very different worlds.
Well, I think that touches on another feature, actually, and that is the tendency for millennials to be more global in outlook, do you think, Andre? I was thinking about, for example, in the debate in the UK over the EU, Remain or Exit, it was overwhelmingly the young people who saw the world as a bigger place, who wanted to remain in Europe, and it was the older people who were like, no, let's go back to little Britain. Is there something in that, do you think, that millennials generally do see the borders as less important and see the world as a global entity?
Well, I guess millennials, at least in Australia, are more likely to have parents who were born overseas, and so that's already a moment of global connection. But and then everyone else has talked as well about the element of communication. But if I might say something about the work ethic, which we get slated for a little bit. I mean, one thing that I find interesting is, you know, you go back and read someone like John Maynard Keynes, and he said that we would be working about 15 hours a week by now. And so, I mean, my question there is, you know, what happened to that future? Particularly, you know, and we talk about automation and robots taking away jobs. And I think the social justice but futuristic way of looking at that would say, well, what's the problem with that if we create a society where that's not an issue, where you have something like a universal basic income or similar programs that mean that automation doesn't mean that people are destitute, that we don't have a system where you have to find work or you starve. So that's, I think, an interesting question about the future.
But it also requires, does it not, addressing some of the structural extreme inequality that we're seeing in countries like Australia, in Western countries, around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. And that, I mean, that ties in with your question about our global connectedness. As I think something I found growing up as well is we felt so connected to the rest of the world through television and then through the internet. And that's true as well of disasters and of people suffering overseas. But there's this strange disconnect where we're both connected and we see the vision. But I think and I think, Holly, you raised that in terms of what our, you know, empathy and how our brains connect to people that we see on screens. And there's still an open question as to whether or not seeing suffering on a TV screen will lead to actually doing something about it, or if you just have that moment where you feel a bit of sympathy and then you move on.
Yeah. Well, let's come to Smashed Avocados. This notorious claim that millennials spend too much time in cafes eating smashed avocado on toast, and it's this attitude that explains why housing is unaffordable to them. But it also suggests, I think, apart from trivialising housing prices, it suggests that the aspirations of millennials are different to previous generations, that in a sense they would prefer to go to a cafe and have something nice to eat and drink than be tied to a job that they don't like just so that they can simply buy a home. Holly, what do you make of that? What do you make of the do millennials have the same aspirations to own their own home, for example?
It's an interesting one. I'll be intrigued for Jennifer's views on this too. But I think we're at an inflection point on this, to be perfectly honest. But I think the data that we've seen up to this point is still overwhelmingly strong for the aspiration of young Australians to want to own a home. Because I think that idea of owning a home is such a quintessential component of the Australian dream. And there was a want to kind of follow in the footsteps. And in many ways, it was a socialised expectation that was passed on from grandparents to parents to now you. I think the reason we're at an inflection point, though, is naturally you reach a point where you go, I don't want to aspire to something that I don't believe is attainable because I'm setting myself up for a life of misery. And I think what we see when we read things like the Mission Australia survey, which captures a pretty good snapshot of the kind of mental well-being and views of young Australians, is there's very high presentation of anxiety. There's a very high level of stress and worry and concern. And of a lot of it's related to my ability to one day own the home and ability to one day, you know, have a job or find a job that can provide for me to be able to have the life that I want to. So I think that's where we start to see the emerging conversation around, well, does that need to be what it all is about? In fact, why don't I just enjoy life here in this moment? If I want to catch up with friends and go out for breakfast, if I want to go travel and explore the world, why don't I do that? Because to suspend life and the enjoyment of the now in pursuit of something that may never be able to be mine seems futile. And I guess the thing I would say, because I think a lot of people critique millennials for having that viewpoint some of the time, but the overwhelming anecdotal conversations I have with baby boomer parents of millennials is that they 100% expect they're going to help their children into the housing market.
Yeah.
And that will be an intergenerational effort to ensure that their children own property in Australia.
Mm. Yeah. Tamika, do you think about owning a home? Is that one of those things that you aspire to or would aspire to if it was affordable for you?
I think we'd all love to own a home, but I think that I agree. I think I'd rather just be happy than to, yeah, try and get to something that may not ever happen. And yeah, when you just said, you know, it's an intergenerational thing, I just think to myself, well, you know, what hope do my mob have then? Because, you know, we're trying to break out of this. So yeah, it's a bit of a worry as well.
I think the important thing is that young people today may or may not want those things. And there is a discussion to have about whether or not what we want is actually changing as our lives become more global and all that sort of thing. But the fundamental point really is, should we be able to if we wanted to? And I think everyone would agree that the answer to that is yes. But the situation currently is that that is not the case. Mm. So even if you wanted to, generally young people can't. And that's really the important question. This whole narrative about do young people want it anymore is in some ways a post facto justification for the fact that we actually couldn't even if we did.
Mm.
I'd also point out that I called Bernard Salt a syndicated bore in the book long before he wrote that avocado column.
And I think your point is really key there with the when we compare it generationally, the amount it would now cost the younger generation to break into the housing market is substantially different to previous generations. So
seven
when we
times
equalize
average income for people our age as opposed to three times average income when my parents were looking for a home.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a significant difference.
Yeah, because I think sometimes the argument's thrown back, oh, they're not prepared to sacrifice, they're not prepared to start. You know, but now you look at how far you would have to go outside of a CBD in Australia to be able to break into anything that's under the even the $800,000 mark, to be perfectly honest. And that's, again, even setting the bar for a first home quite high. And you're going an incredibly long way out, which means a substantial commute to work and lost time and productivity and what have you. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important that we put that generational comparison in there.
And, I mean, I know numbers are boring generally, but when my parents were looking for their first home, the average mortgage in today's dollars for a first home buyer was $81,000. Today it's $365,000. Like, you can see the difference that actually makes in terms of how attainable it is for someone to get that kind of money together, to have a deposit on a house that they can borrow, and then what that flow-on effects on their lifestyle is. So I think that the economics of it does matter a lot.
Andre, how aware are millennials of this intergenerational wealth issue, that if, for example, your parents have some money and want to help you out in buying a home, that puts you at such a huge advantage over others that it's in a sense quite an uneven playing field?
Well, it's as simple as I don't know anyone who owns a home that didn't get help from their parents. And that's a sharp difference when you take into account people's parents' backgrounds, you know. And so I think it builds on inequality, and you get sort of that widening gap as opposed to what should be a closing gap of inequality. And I think that, yeah, it does become really clear, particularly in the buying of houses, that's probably the area that I see it the most is where parents are able to help out some, and some people don't have that.
I don't know anyone that owns a home, come to think of it.
Didn't the Prime Minister make some comment on this, Frank? The weights were put on him about the rising cost of home ownership, and he said, the parents should just kick in and help their kids to buy a home. The assumption being that Australia is full of all of these parents with a lazy few $100,000 lying around that they can give to their kids.
Up there with get a good job that pays good money.
Yeah.
Well, that was Joe Hockey, wasn't it?
It was.
It was John Fain in Melbourne, wasn't it? John Fain was interviewing him on Melbourne Morning ABC. And, Malcolm Turnbull asked, well, John, you're pretty well off, aren't you? You could afford to kick in a bit for your kids. And John Fain probably is, and I'm sure that Malcolm Turnbull is, but, politicians are always at their most interesting in those unguarded moments, and that looked to me when I saw it as an unguarded moment, and it's when the big mentalities are suddenly exposed and expressed, and the mentality there is that we have a kind of patrimonial society, as John Quiggin has just called it, in which inheritance, once again, as in the 19th century, for instance, becomes a critical determinant of people's opportunities in life, including the opportunity to own your own home, with all of the sort of quality of life issues bound up in that.
And watching politicians navigate the policy landscape in the next 5 to 10 years is going to be really interesting, in part because you're going to see a division of something that for the last generation we've had fused. So right now, millennials are the largest generation in our workforce. They're at about the 34-36% mark, depending on what data you're looking at. But the expectation is that by 2025, that'll grow to between 2/3 and 3/4 of the Australian workforce. So what we're going to have happen is a retirement of baby boomers, which is the reason such a large percentage of the workforce will be millennial. But the baby boomer generation in and of itself is substantially larger than the millennial generation in sheer aggregate numbers. So the lion's share of your voter base is not going to be the lion's share of your workforce. Mm. And that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out on so many of these intergenerational issues. Do you play to the economy and productivity and change that's going to allow the unleashing of that potential and the creation of the greatest value, or do you play to the voter base and perhaps the stability and the security of the now? Because traditionally the reason we keep the now is that, don't bite the hand that feeds you.
Look, the workplace has changed so dramatically over the past 10 years or so, and it's millennials who are right at the coalface of this change. And I just wonder how much do millennials yearn for the type of stability in the workplace that previous generations had versus how much are they embracing this new gig economy and the opportunities that it provides?
Well, I think the first thing to say about
scoffing
that is
at the gig economy, I've noticed.
People generally want to make enough money to live comfortably. I think that is kind of a universal value. And the idea that millennials embrace and enjoy the gig economy, which might see them doing 3 to 5 jobs because that's what it takes to actually keep body and soul together, and they're always on, they're always working, they're at the beck and call of an app rather than an employer or a company or a culture, is bullshit, to be honest. Again, it's a post facto justification for circumstances that have sort of been imposed by how the economy is working now. Nobody wants to really live that way, not by and large, maybe a very small number of people. People want to make enough money to have a decent life, and the gig economy makes that really difficult.
Mm. And people, I think, also want to do what they were trained for or what they were educated for, and I think that's a huge factor for millennials is, and you said it before, hugely educated, but how many people get jobs in the field that they were trained in? And that's, I think, very disillusioning. And that's been an interesting thing to look at in the Anglosphere, at least, I think, is you have people who are actually from solidly middle-class backgrounds going, well, I can't own a home, I'm not able to get a job in the field that I spent a lot of money getting myself educated for. And then you do see a turn to the hard left and the hard right. And I think something that gets missed a bit is that the alt-right is, there's a large young male contingent behind that as well. Mm. It's not just, I think people maybe think that it's older white people, older blue collar workers. It's also very young middle class background men who are extremely angry about what they perceive as their relative fall in privilege and status.
And if I could go to a point, because this touches on the topic of my new book, which is The Economic Prospects of Blue-Collar Workers, which is something I'm working on at the moment, it very much overlaps with that, is that male younger workers who are not tertiary educated in particular have seen a very significant decline in their relative economic prospects, in their social standing in the community. And they are, it's just a lot of the people that are embracing these quite extremist politics, because they, it used to be the case that you could get a trade and then a good solid job and you would work in that job for 20 or 30 years and be quite comfortable and secure, and that is completely disappearing.
And I think that speaks to this, the reality of this new agile economy that we're in, where we're talking to young people who are in high school right now about the fact that they're going to have 12 careers over the course of their lifetime, most of which have not been invented yet. This very fluid world of work is an incredibly exciting and leverageable opportunity for the highly skilled and highly networked. It's really scary and insecure for the people that are not in such a privileged position. And that picks up on what Andre and Tamika have already said, sort of this challenge that we've got around the way that we stand poised to compound intergenerational inequality. That's the real concern about
it. But even
here
at the moment, those people who you would think are well-equipped for the current economy, who've gone to university, who've done fairly well at university, come out the other end, and there's just nothing for them except underemployment, maybe driving a Uber, working at the coffee shop. You know, and on top of that, the debts just keep mounting up. I'm just wondering whether there are people, whether you feel ripped off by this reality.
In the legal sector, I know that when, say, the Chief Justice of Victoria gives her welcome speech to new graduates when they're being admitted to the legal profession, one of the things that has made its way into that speech now, I think, is, look, it's a really difficult job market out there. And that's from the get-go, you're told constantly that it's a difficult job market. But one effect of that, I think, is it also leaves people more open to being exploited, because they go, well, maybe, you know, this is my only chance to get my foot in the door, is to work for incredibly low wages or to work for someone who treats me really poorly.
That's because there's over 40 universities in Australia now, and almost all of them offer a law degree. What do they think is going to happen to all of these law graduates?
Well, I'm a recovering law student, and I can say I walked out with my $60,000 in hex debt for a legal graduation year in my state of 700 for 200 legal jobs. So that's a great example of how we just oversupplied an industry in my year by 500. But I think this speaks to a really, really big issue that we've got in Australia right now, which is the incredible disconnect between our higher education and institutions and universities, research and business. Like the last time the OECD did the kind of rankings across 33 countries, we got the wooden spoon. We got 33 out of 33 for the gap that exists between those two spaces. So it doesn't surprise me, unfortunately, that we're seeing young people walking out with qualifications that aren't a match for what industry are after. I think the challenge that we've got is making sure that those two catch up. And my worry is certainly the curriculum side of things, and the fact we've seen not just very little change to the content of the curriculum, but very little change to the pedagogy, the actual way we go about teaching, given that we're sending people out and having to apply learning in a really different way in the current work market and job market than they previously had to in other generations. You know, much more problem solving, much more information synthesis, those sorts of things, much more entrepreneurialism. So I think that's a really big challenge, and I think how we bring those two closer together is going to be absolutely critical.
And Tamika, these issues are compounded for Indigenous millennials, aren't they?
Yeah, so I work on employment policy, and that's one of the biggest challenges is how do we get people into jobs when, you know, the whole economy's basically gone downhill. It's almost like you have to look at where the growth market is and aim to be in that, even if it's not something that you're passionate about. Yeah, it's a challenge.
Is there a sense that millennials just want the 50 and 60 somethings to get out of the way, vacate the space?
Problem. So you talked about, you know, the baby boomers will leave the workforce and we will make up a greater share of it. That's true, but it's still some way off. And what we are seeing, I actually crunched some numbers on this for the book, is that the CEOs, departmental secretaries, newspaper editors, these kind of senior roles in society are now between 6 and 8 years older than they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago on average. People are staying in the workforce longer because they're healthier, you know, they're up for it. In a lot of cases, the global financial crisis actually wiped out wealth that people had when they were close to retirement, so they need to stay in the workforce. And that's creating this kind of logjam all the way through the pipeline where you can't get the progression that used to be available because people are staying at the top much longer than they used to.
Frank, how are historians likely to remember millennials? This is in the realm of speculation. After listening to what you've listened to and had a bit of a sample of the attitudes and the challenges, in, you know, 20, 30 years' time, when we look back on this generation, how are we going to
Take for granted that the millennial as a category will survive. I mean, its predecessor, if I remember rightly, was Generation Y, which we don't hear much about now. So, I mean, whether it will be a meaningful category, I don't know. I think, the association with digital technology will be powerful. Again, when I look at the 80s, I mean, the things that people often remember, apart from the popular culture and bad haircuts, are, of course, the outmoded technologies, which we look at now and think are really cute, things like Walkmans and so on. And I think that connection association will be important. But, you know, I think it may well be thought of as a post-GFC generation. I think a lot of what we've talked about tonight has really been about, you know, how do we deal with that world? It's a different world. That's really the difference between you guys and me, you know, a Generation Xer. When I left university as an undergraduate in Melbourne, unemployment in Melbourne itself, Victoria, for instance, was about 13%. Much higher than today. I mean, my prospects didn't look terribly good either, so, of course, I went off and did a PhD. but, it was the middle of a recession. It looked pretty ordinary. But the big difference, of course, is that it was followed by this period of recovery and then, of course, quite explosive growth. Mm. But that's not where we are now. We're in a very different world now. And so
and
I think that
technological change, too, is going to dramatically change the workforce. In fact, you're the generation that's going to have to deal with the pointy end of climate change, the massive changes to the workforce that will be brought about by artificial intelligence.
Yep, and the robots.
Robots. You know, I heard the other day that there are 3D printers that can print 10 houses on a block of land in China in 24 hours.
But that could be good, right? You know, because then there's more houses.
Well, that could be good. More housing.
There we go.
Just don't need human beings to build them, though.
We can't print land, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. Hey, we got a lot of that.
I wonder how you feel about the kind of challenges that you're up against and the optimism or otherwise that you have for your generation being able to take on those challenges. Andre, I think you were sceptical of the techno-utopianism that exists at the moment, that technology and innovation provides the solution to everything. Are you optimistic, though? And do you retain a sense of utopianism about the future?
Well, in terms of optimism, I mean, and this hasn't come up as much on this panel as I thought it might have, but in terms of climate change, when you really look at the things that come out of, say, the Food and Agricultural Organization said that we have about 60 harvests left before our soil is so degraded because of the current farming practices that privilege, short-term profits, and they don't put enough nutrients back into the soil. Like, that, to me, is such a sort of impossible thing to think about in terms of, you know, how can you feel optimistic about that kind of a future? The flip side to that, though, is I think that we absolutely need to have utopian thinking in terms of these things about, you know, facing automation and robotics. The utopian future looks like, I think, that we could work less and still materially feed ourselves and house ourselves and clothe ourselves. And that's the utopian future that I would like us to focus on, as opposed to the utopian future that utopian thinking that underpins the current economy, which is this idea of endless resources, which is just as utopian.
I wonder whether you have a sense that there are defining moments that are happening now that we will look back on in the years to come as being important junctures. You know, I wonder whether we perhaps would have thought that about the Paris Climate Change Agreement, where we managed to get all of the developing countries and China, all of the countries on the page to commit to a treaty, not a perfect treaty, but nonetheless. But then, of course, one of the biggest emitters in the world pulls out of that treaty. Are there things happening now that you think we'll look back on as being defining moments?
I think Frank, as a historian, might say that those things are often hard to spot at the time,
yes,
because it's only the things that flow from them that make them particularly significant.
Well, remember the Trump presidency. I'm confident about that.
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah. But if I could just go back to pick up something from Andre's point there as well. I actually don't think that what we need is utopian thinking, because there are really practical solutions to basically every problem we have in front of us. You know,
spoken like a true political advisor.
There are policy reforms that could make housing more affordable right now, and we know what they are, and it's only the political system that is slowing those down. We know what reforms are needed to start making the transition from a carbon-based economy to a clean economy. We know that we need more TAFE for better educating younger Australians. Like, these are things that there are practical solutions for. We don't need to burn the whole system down and start again, as the kind of utopians would have us do. We need to do the things that are sensible now, I suppose.
Okay.
Well, I think one thing you've already touched on that definitely will be a defining moment when we make it happen, and again, it's an example of the political process stymieing something we've touched on already, but is the push for same-sex marriage. So I think that will be a really significant moment in social progress that has in many ways been led by this younger generation.
I might just say, in terms of when I say utopian thinking, what I'm thinking of, I guess, is what's the ideal future that we want? And in order to have practical solutions, you need to have that base idea of, like, where are we headed and what do we want to head to? And to me, one thing would be to say, you know, a truly egalitarian society where everyone has, you know, equal opportunity to flourish and succeed. And that's feels utopian at the moment.
Also, Australia is such a young country. Like, what we do now is truly, we're writing our history right now. I believe that.
Okay, that's where we have to leave our discussion at the National Museum of Australia. Thanks to the museum, thanks to our guests, Andre Dow, Jen Rayner, Holly Ransom, Frank Bongiorno and Tamika Townsend. Thanks to you and the audience for coming along. You've been listening to Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now. Okay, thanks very much. We're going to take some questions from the floor. As is usually the advice I give at moments like this, please refrain from short speeches disguised as questions. Questions are always better than speeches. But we do really want to hear from you. So in the short space of time we have left, let's get through as many questions as we can.
How do you, as people that work with young people that advise on policy and that interact with lots of people, deal with the fact that there's a huge gap in the generation millennial? Like, a lot of the experiences you're talking about, they're not experiences that I had. By the time 9/11 happened and I understood it, it'd already been a thing. Terrorism was already a word that was, like, well into our vocabularies. So, like, how do you cope with that gap? Because the things that happened to you were the world as I knew it, but I'm still a millennial.
I think it's really important to listen as well as talk in that sense. So your life has 100% been shaped by those events. I have absolutely no doubt about that. Like, if you having the perspective of being, how old was I, 14 when September 11 happened, thereabouts, like, I can very clearly, and I think Holly's reflected on that, see how the world was different between those points. And so it's useful to have that perspective in order to say it hasn't always been this way and it could be different, but then to listen to you about how, and, you know, people who are younger in the generation, about how the experience of not knowing it being any different shapes what you think about it. Because, for example, if you thought that the security state that has kind of sprung up around that was completely okay and acceptable, that's part of the dialogue that we would have to come to terms with.
Okay.
Sorry. Andre touched on earlier the often disproportionate acclaim that technology receives in determining the future of young people. I just wanted to ask Frank, where does the arts lie in shaping the future of Australia's young people?
The arts, you say? Well, underestimated, I think, as ever, but incredibly important in the sense that when we think about, you know, what is this post-robotic world going to look like, it's clear that a whole range of activities that at the moment in many cases are perhaps on the margins of what people are doing are going to become increasingly central. I mean, The whole area of lifelong education as we get ageing populations is a good example of that, and the arts is surely another. But, you know, when we... I mean, it's a part of being human. It's also a part, I think, of how a community defines itself is through the arts. And you know, it's clear that that is important. It of course, requires... It's a bit like Jen's point about TAFE. I mean, it also requires investment by government because we need people to be educated to be able to lead that effort, to teach, you know, to actually create that kind of world. So, you know, I think it's immensely important.
There's also a feedback loop, I think, between technology and the arts that sometimes goes unacknowledged, but I'm pretty sure everyone in Silicon Valley has watched Star Wars a lot of, many, many times. And you get this kind of like, you know, the futures that artists paint or write often feed their way back into the technology we create.
Yeah. It's also the case, I mean, there's a lot of research going on at the moment on what jobs are most vulnerable to technological displacement, so, you know, who's going to get displaced by a robot, and the current working theory is that it's about cognitive and routine tasks. So if a task is highly routine and non-cognitive, then it can easily be done by a robot. If a task is very cognitive, then it really essentially can never be done by a robot until we get AI that's so freaky it can kind of AI itself. And so jobs in the arts are probably some of the least vulnerable jobs to technological disruption. The problem is that currently they are also some of the least funded, least available jobs. So there's an interesting tension there.
I love the observation that's implied in your question, though, because I think it goes to the heart of what I hope our generation can break down, which is the siloed nature of thinking and the siloed nature of connecting in many ways, because it's always often that there's arts over here, there's sport over there, there's business here, and that you know, they shall never meet. And I think it's so critical that we're really intentional. When I think about the words diversity, inclusion, I think about how we bring those thinking, those perspectives, people from those sorts of backgrounds together, how we see much more movement between sectors than we do right now, probably. I think that's really important moving forward, and I think the arts has an enormous role to play in every aspect of our lives.
It also reminds me of that Winston Churchill quote, in the middle of the Second World War, when it was put to him in Cabinet that they should cut back arts funding to fund the war, and Churchill said, well, why are we fighting the war then?
That's brilliant. I love that.
Thank you. That was a wonderful discussion of the global. Can I ask you about what millennials are thinking about in terms of the planetary, that is, environments, not just climate change and food security, which came in very late, but vanishing extinctions, melting glaciers, water stress, and that is on non-human others, not just humans. Thanks.
Well, I think it's a challenge to all of our existing philosophies of what we value and what we count as good things, and this will feed into the policy decisions. Hopefully one day will feed into the policy decisions made by politicians, but... I think we need to actually... We're not actually at a point where we've worked out the moral value of forests, of rivers yet. And there's been some movement in legal spheres for environmental objects to have the right to sue on their own behalf, or for people, of course, but to sue on the behalf of rivers, of forests. I think it's a powerful idea. You know, if you could sue on the behalf of the Great Barrier Reef, could that be a better way of preventing something like the Adani coal mine than I think some of the shenanigans that have gone on with native title, which, you know, really obscures the real debate. And whereas if you squarely were able to challenge the Adani coal mine on the basis of its effect on, say, the reef, that would be a much more straightforward argument.
I think possibly one of the reasons that doesn't get the attention that maybe it should is that people do sort of think that there will be a solution when the problem really comes. So I don't know that my generation genuinely believes we're going to have water wars, for example, because we sort of think in the back of our minds that someone will have come up with a solution to water by then, you know, whether it is desalination becoming a cheap and viable technology solution, and then you've got all the oceans, so, you know, what's your problem? I do think there is sort of a slightly possibly misguided optimism about our capacity to just solve problems when they come up, which is leading us to probably not do the planning or the engagement that maybe is required.
And I think as well, with just the amount of information we have swirling around, we have this challenge of the immediacy of it to confront. Like, well, I was in Auckland this week working with all the local government leaders from across New Zealand. There could not be more of a central focus around water and climate change and community resilience for them, because they are living, breathing and seeing its consequences every week, every day. And so I was every conversation was about that. All of the strategy, their people are engaged, they've got citizens, you know, protesting, citizens collaborating, you name it. Whereas I think, you know, I remember growing up in primary school and we were on tight water restrictions. You got fined if you were using your sprinklers on certain days. Even that seems to have disappeared from sort of the way that this is permeating the day-to-day and allowing me as an individual to understand how I can play a contributing role to helping on some of the things that you're talking about. And that's where I think even Craig Rucastle's program on waste on the ABC has been really interesting at the moment. The way I've watched cafes in my local area get rid of cardboard cups, the way that I've watched people start to be more intentional around recycling, purely by him creating a visual and an immediate understanding of our, in that instance, pollution footprint daily. So I think more of that is really critical to driving that consciousness that we need.
I think the interest is there too. There's a group, I don't know if you've heard of the group called Seed, but they're a young group of young people advocating for climate justice.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's to no one in particular, but I'm wondering whether millennials, how they feel about the transition away from the Anglo-American relationships towards an Asian century, and how millennials may feel placed, particularly with the emergence of we are dealing with such a profound shift with China and the growth of China, and let's be frank, the increasing aggression of China within our regional space.
Well, I've done a couple of exchange programs cultural exchange programs through writers' residencies and writers' festivals in Indonesia and Vietnam. And one interesting thing about that, I think, is, you know, we talk about this Asian century that, you know, in Australia has to make this pivot to Asia. But it was fascinating talking to all these writers in those countries, and they said, "Do you write books in Australia?" We had no, you know, like they have no interest in or awareness of what we produce culturally. And so this idea that we would deign to turn towards Asia, I think, is a little bit high-handed when we might need to get their attention.
I think that's a really, really good point, because I am a Bahasa Indonesia speaker and I've spent some time living over there. And there's this sense in Australia that when we're ready, we will kind of turn to Indonesia and we will have this great economic relationship when they're sufficiently wealthy and middle class and when it suits us, and when we've kind of, you know, we've done China and we've done India, then we'll turn to Indonesia and that's where our opportunities are. And they couldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Like, we've missed that boat. They have a certain set of views about Australia, which is that we're essentially the colonials of the region, so we're kind of trying to get over some history there, and then they have moved on. We are not important to them. And so I think that that's a really important point, that we think that we're making this turn to Asia. Asia doesn't care.
Well, if you go to Vietnam, it's full of Japanese and Korean construction companies who are pumping money, investment.
China as well, like, you know, China investing in the country.
So
I think that's I also think, like, young people don't necessarily have that same perspective that we need to make a pivot to Asia, because it's just been more of our engagement going on. So it's just one of many relationships that we would have. I think that idea of moving from the Anglosphere to the Asia-Pacific is probably also an idea that's relevant to earlier generations.
Absolutely.
One more question.
With the trend that's occurring towards this globalised world and networks, do you think it's important that we force our leaders to reckon with this idea, rather than lagging behind this decision point?
I would come back to the point that it's up to us to change things rather than to expect other people to do it for us. So one of the best ways that we would get our leaders to be thinking about these issues is to be actually in the space where they are in, having those conversations with them. Like, I mean, my work background is in the Australian Federal Parliament for the Labor Party, and I have seen how incredibly effective young parliamentarians like Tim Watts and Claire O'Neill and Sam Dastyari and Jim Chalmers have been in shifting the conversation towards issues that actually matter to younger people, because they can't help but bring those perspectives to the conversations that they have. And so when you sit around
around a table with the shadow cabinet or with whoever, you know, political leaders that you're dealing with, and they say, here's an issue about housing affordability. The younger people are saying, yes, but we don't own a house, and here's why, and here are the things you need to think about with that. So we can't make our leaders do things without being part of that process, I guess.
Okay. That may have to be a wrap for this evening. Thanks for coming along. This program, an edited version of it, will appear on my radio program, Big Ideas, via podcast and on RN. We're on every evening at 8 p.m. Monday to Thursdays and repeated the next day at 2. So look out for it. But I think I'll hand back to the museum to wrap up the proceedings.
Great. Well, museum would definitely like to thank the panel for being here tonight. This was an absolutely fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed it. Thanks to Paul, as always, for being here. And thanks to the audience for coming out. Thank you very much. Another thank you to our wine sponsor, Capital Wines, and the catering prior. And Paul doesn't have a broadcast gate just yet, so stay tuned for that. And please keep in mind that the next panel in the Defining Moments series will be, I believe, August 26th in association with the Canberra Writers Festival, and it's going to be about defining woman in Australian history. So again, please join me in thanking the panel, thanking Paul for a fantastic conversation.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.